Hiya, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and this podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Perth. I pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Sovereignty never ceded. On this episode, I talk with the co-directors Indiana Bell and Josiah Allen about their first feature film, You'll Never Find Me. Building on their impressive short film work with Call Connect and The Recordist, You'll Never Find Me sees a visitor, played by Jordan Cowan, who knocks on the door of Patrick, played by Brendan Rock. She's lost and it's pouring outside, and she's in the middle of nowhere. And his caravan is the only source of sanctuary that she could find. Or is it? What follows is a twisting, turning tarot character piece where two figures push and probe each other, trying to figure out just who the other is. It's a double-hander that plays a lot like a card game, with bluffing, truth revealing, and an ultimate tension playing out. I've long been a fan of what Indiana and Josiah have managed to do with their filmmaking brilliance in South Australia. Call Connect is a short film that easily stands as one of the most riveting and powerful shorts I've ever seen, and The Recordist is no different. The two have crafted visual style with their work that is equally amplified by sound design that creates an immersive sonic landscape that elevates the scripts that Indiana writes. If there is a future of an independent filmmaking in Australia to keep an eye out for, then it's in the heart of Adelaide with Indy and Josiah's work. I really, really applaud what they're doing, and I really can't wait to see their filmmaking career go forth. You'll Never Find Me launches at the Melbourne International Film Festival on August 16th, with a second screening on the 19th of August. Head over to miff.com.au for further details and to pick up tickets. To listen to previous or read previous interviews with filmmakers whose work is screened at MIFF, then head over to thecurb.com.au. So let's get started talking about You'll Never Find Me. It is a really effective film. I guess, Indy, we'll start with you. Where did the idea come from for this?
Well, it was not very organic, the way that the idea for the story itself came about. Basically, we knew that we wanted to make a feature, and we knew that we were going to have to be really practical in terms of what we can achieve on a low budget. And we knew that that needed to be something that we had in mind from the script stage, rather than having this great, wonderful, grand idea, writing the script for it, and then trying to like rework it for a lower budget. Yeah. So, you know, normally when you're writing a script, you have a conversation with someone, or, you know, you listen to a piece of music, or, you know, you overhear something and it kind of sparks the idea for a story. This really was not that at all. It was, okay, we know we want to do something in a single location, and we really enjoyed working with Brendan Rock and Jordan Cowan, the two actors that we had made a short film with called The Recordist. Okay, what can we do with these two people? One is an older guy and one's a young woman. What kind of dynamics does that present? If you put them in a single location together, what stories come out of that? So it was kind of just about brainstorming different locations and what that would do, and, you know, kind of pulling at those threads to see where they would lead in terms of an interesting story idea. And then we kind of came to this, and it was like, okay, cool, this is what we're doing.
That sounds very like it's pragmatic, and it's realizing what the working within the limitations. But I tell you what, like this is a massive film in one location. Like, you've got so much going on, and a lot of it comes down to cinematography. Obviously, script and performances and direction is there, but cinematography, the production design, and then the sound design as well. So, as you're saying, like, you have to have this idea in your mind of what you're creating at the end of it in the script level. But were those aspects also baked into the script and the conception of what you're going to be creating as well?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because we wanted to have a script that was really well thought out, so that when we came to all of the normal hurdles that are thrown at you when you get to the actual production stage, that we could really concentrate on them, rather than like reworking the script constantly and trying to think of new ways to reinvent it. So a lot of the sound design was written into the script because for that same reason of being really practical. We knew we wanted to do this story that was set in during a storm, but on a really low budget. And the second that you bring in rain rigs and lightning and all that kind of stuff, things become really not very low budget anymore. So we went, okay, in script stage, how can we minimize the amount that we actually see the storm, but still make it believable and make the audience really aware that there is this constant threat outside and it's still raging on, even though we can't see it all the time. So
yeah, sound's always been in our short films a big priority for us. And I know everyone says, oh, sound's really important, but like we are just big sound nerds. We've always, our short films have always been really small. And I think that if there's any scale to them, we've tended to get it through sound. So in designing the film, we were very much had in mind that we would be leaning very heavily on some really tricksy lighting with our amazing cinematographer, Max Corkendale, and then music and sound. We just went from the beginning for the amount of time and resources we had. We put a lot into the sound. Duncan Campbell, our sound designer, and Darren Lynn, our composer, they just, we kind of handed them this big challenge of, you know, if you take away all that stuff, it's very sparse, you know, what we were cutting to, like we were doing some sound and stuff like that as we were going, as we always do. We knew that we were making something that would really rely heavily on that. And they took up the challenge. And I think it just sounds amazing. They did so well.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I find it really interesting as you're talking about the Recordist and Core Connect and now this, how you have, you know, throughout your films, you're playing with sound and playing with the nature of how sound is presented in a film, and mostly like putting us into the space of the characters as well. Obviously, Core Connect, we're sitting there listening to a conversation take place. The sound is not as complex, but it still puts us into the space. And then the Recordist with the headphones and things like that, which is such an atmospheric and powerful thing. And then this, which is just everything, it's like, it feels like a natural conclusion to what you've been working towards. What draws you to telling a story on a sonic level? And where did that interest in telling a sonic story come from?
I guess it's kind of like twofold, because on one side it's, you know, what we're talking about before in terms of like, how can we achieve the feeling of scale on a low budget, and that like sound does 90% of the work in films. And it's something that you don't have to have 10 massive expensive rain rigs to create a storm. You just need a great sound designer to create a storm. So there's that level of it in terms of we are, you know, trying to push what we can do within the budget constraints that we have. And same thing with our short films. But then there's, the creative side of it in terms of we just love sound, and we love films that really, really use that to their advantage. And kind of, we always find that films are way more thrilling and terrifying when they're using sound and music as a tool over visuals. You know, it's that whole thing of, rather than seeing the monster, I want to hear the monster, and I'm going to be way more scared in that way, because, you know, nothing is more terrifying than your imagination. So when it fills in all the gaps for you, it can be a really effective tool. So it's kind of twofold like that, in that we just really love that in films, and and just really appreciate films that use sound like that, but also just from a practical standpoint as well.
Yeah. we both I guess learnt to lean on it, not to save us, not to get us out of trouble, but from early on we learnt to lean on it through, obviously, doing stuff with short films. But even when we were kids, you know, some of our home videos, It's like, you know, you'd experiment with sound as a kid, and that would be the thing that suddenly made something watchable. I know, like, showing that she's the writer, her childhood videos, when you see them, they're story driven. they're amazing. You know, she's seven, and they're complex plots. I used to, when I was like 7, 8, 9, copy scenes. I would watch a scene and I would try and achieve, you know, like a fight, like something action-y or something like that. And you know, I just had little home video recorder and like I bully my friends or family to be in it. They were all good sports about it. But it would always be, you know, unwatchable until you put, I would sometimes like rip, which is dodgy, but I was seven. I would like record actual sound from a movie for the scene I was trying to copy, and I would cut what I had done to that sound, and suddenly it was completely watchable and it made sense to the audience, to parents, friends. And I know that sounds funny. That was a really powerful lesson that sometimes I think back on of like, you know, as a kid, you're like, oh, now it works. Now people understand it. But that just shows that it's 50% of it. And if you pull the sound and music out, just everything just isn't immersive and no. just doesn't flow rhythmically as well.
So let's talk about your directing relationship, how that's changed over the years with the shorts and to the features. How have you found that it's worked with you both and you've evolved over time?
Yeah, when we first met each other in uni and we started to do our first few shorts together, we were coming from two different strengths. Like I would write the scripts and I was coming from, you know, I did a little bit of like high school drama and all that kind of stuff. And I really enjoyed the performance aspect of it. And, you know, when I'm writing the scripts, I can really imagine how the actors deliver the lines. So it's like I was coming from more of that performance side and working with actors side. And then Joe was coming from a really visual side. And he's the one who's really into editing and, you know, storyboarding and thinking about lens choices and all that kind of stuff. So when we'd come together, it was, you know, when we first started, it was quite separate in a way. But now as we have worked more together, we're kind of learning off of each other and just through the process of filmmaking and getting stronger in the areas that we were not perhaps as strong in, so that we're kind of hopefully evening out a little bit. And it's something that we still lean on, which is really helpful when we're like in emergency situations on set and you're like running out of time and you're like, okay, I'm going to go talk to the actors. You go talk to Max. Yeah. And we can kind of split off and it's really efficient in that way. But, you know, as we're working more and more together, we want to become more of a unit where we're both doing like, you know, an even amount in both areas, which I think we are getting better at.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like, hopefully it's not noticeable to an actor, for instance, or someone on set until there is a time emergency where we do need to split off, or you know, in rehearsals I tend to try and actually not engage as much. We did rehearsals for this because so much of it is play like, and again, it's not like I'm not there, it's not like I'm not talking, but I try and be a first audience member when Indiana's written the script. So we really try and make that purely a process of between the actors and the writer to get the writer intention before the writer gets fired by herself being a director, and we are working on now adapting that. We try and keep those two as kind of a separate process, which is really fun. By the time we get on set, it really is nowadays, I think, most importantly about, because we're looking for, we still have different strengths that we know of. It really is about getting across an idea as quickly as possible. So if we, you know, watch a take and we look at each other, we can have quick discussion. We have a shorthand, obviously, at this stage. It's about just working out what we need to do to improve something or, what we want out of a scene as quickly as possible. And there's just no better way of doing it as, you know, being that audience member watching a take than being just turn to someone you trust, go, what do you reckon? And then whoever can articulate that quickest tends to take the lead, and the other person kind of comes in as well, but just adds to that discussion.
So when you're working with somebody like Brendan and Jordan, who you've had a working relationship with before, how do you help them build the characters? I mean, Brendan is such a, his visual screen presence is so, he's a complex figure really on screen, both menacing, but also kind of warm and comfortable too, which is a real difficult balance. And then Jordan is, you know, vulnerable, but also there's this potential for threat there. So how do you go about creating those characters with them?
Well, it was definitely a process. And we, like you said before, we did rehearsal for this because of the fact that it's so dialogue heavy and so play-like, we knew that it wasn't something that we could just rock up on the day and shoot. We needed to talk about it heaps. We needed to try out different ways of going with the scenes and with the characters, and we needed to develop it heaps with Brendan and Jordan before we came to set so that we were really prepared. So Brendan and Jordan have both done a lot of theatre, so they were into that, which was really good. Yeah, we just did a lot of rehearsal and a lot of chatting. But the other thing is that it also came out in a process of the editing as well, because on set we were kind of careful to get, we like to get lots of takes. We like to get things with like slight subtle variations so that we can really manipulate it in the edit. And that's what Joe was doing a lot of in the editing process, of going, okay, what does it do if I put in this shot of Patrick Brendan here, you know, where he's looking slightly more suspicious? Okay, that kind of changes the whole read of this section. What if I change it again? Okay, it changes the read again. So it's a lot of manipulation. So yeah, in terms of the performances, we just tried to get small variations, subtle variations in different takes on the day, so that we had that ammo by the time we got to the edit, so that we could really craft what we needed out of a scene, but also change our minds in the edit and go, actually, no, this works better.
Yeah.
We can manipulate people more if we do it this way. So yeah, it's all Brendan and Jordan's work, but just kind of taking that work and messing with it in the edit as well.
And it was a lot more than we've done in the past, purely because of the real-time aspect of it. Yeah, just because it's playing out like a play, we would go with a certain set of takes, and then we would test the film and we'd gauge people's reactions, and there were just, you know, a slightly different look. People would remember that moment and they would call back that moment, and that's what threw them off in not quite the right way. We had certain spots where we just talked about in rehearsal, we're going to get a bunch of takes of this, and it's not, as you said, super subtle. It's nothing silly. It's not like one time we're playing it for laughs and one time, you know.
It's amazing what audiences pick up on and what they can hold on to, sometimes in a great way and sometimes in a way that you don't want. And that was something we had to test when we were doing the edit, because people can really latch onto things and it makes them reinterpret stuff that you don't want them to reinterpret. So you're like, oh God, have to get rid of that shot, you know?
It's the annoying lesson that we're always learning of. It's like, it is the behavior in between all the moments that we're most paying attention to that the audience latches onto as we as filmmakers are trying to tell them something. So always being really on that behavior.
What I find impressive as well about you both is that you do get feedback and audience reactions prior to completing a film. And I don't know it's not something I've asked all Australian filmmakers, but it doesn't seem like something that is common practice. Can you talk about that process and when you decided that that was going to be something you would add into your creative process?
Yeah, I think it's something that was really important for, we've done it previously with our shorts, but we knew with this film specifically, the nature of the film and the whole cat and mouse game that kind of happens throughout it, we just knew that we needed to test it on people, because fundamentally what happens when you're making a movie and you're doing lots of the roles yourself, like editing and everything, it gets to a point where you feel like you can't really see the wood for the trees, and you're like, I need fresh eyes on this to tell me because we know, we inherently know so well the script and the shots that we got on the day, and we know the edit inside out. It gets to a point where you've just looked at it so long that you cannot actually determine what is working and what's not working, what information is tracking and what is just going over people's heads. So you just need fresh eyes. And we knew quite early on that would be something that would be required for this film, just because of the nature of the story. It's not really like a clear cut A, B, C, D storyline. There are lots of little clues and breadcrumbs that we want people to pick up on, but that we also want to wash over people so that it has rewatchability and lots of tricky stuff like that. So I think audience feedback is really valuable and really helped us in the editing process to find out, you know, where the weaknesses in the film were, and that way we could go back and go, okay, how do we fix this?
We always knew from the beginning that we were committing to a style of film that the audience wouldn't be on top of what was going on the entire time, and that was obviously on purpose. Mm. And we knew it would ruin it if everyone understood every single thing as they were going. But then the other side of that is you don't want it to annoy people.
Mm.
You don't want people to feel so lost that they turn it off
mm.
or stop watching it. So it was a tricky balance of we knew that we had the answers, so we wanted to make sure that if someone wanted to watch it again, the answers are there and we're not lying, that, yeah, we're always keeping the audience guessing,
mm.
But hopefully feeling like they're on a ride where they understand enough of what's going on where it's enjoyable.
Mm.
Obviously, one of the pivotal scenes is a card game, but the actual film itself feels like a card game. Can you talk about the choice of the specific card game that's played, Bullshit, which is, you know, this truth and lies kind of thing? Can you choose? Yeah, talk about that.
That's my favorite scene because of the fact that it kind of has stayed exactly what it was meant to be from the start, because it's, you know, in the script it was a certain way, when we did it in rehearsals it was a certain way, when we shot it was a certain way, in the edit it was like the first cut of it,
what's in there.
It pretty much ended up being what it is, so that was really cool because, you know, everything changes when you make a film, but this little bit really didn't, which was kind of cool. But yeah, I knew that at that point of the story I needed a moment where these two characters actually sit down and face one another, and there's actually some form of truths exchanged between the two of them. You know, I thought it would be a fun way to do it with a card game, and specifically with Bullshit, because of the fact that, you know, who do you trust and are they telling the truth and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of just a fun play on that. And we had to make sure that you can actually play Bullshit with two people. We looked it up. You can. With two deck of cards, you can. But yeah, it was just kind of one of those things that, you know, you intuitively feel like you need a moment like that at that point in the film. And this just seemed like a fun way to do it, because as you say, the whole movie is kind of a game between two people, and the audience has to work out what's real and what's not, and what's truth and what's fiction. So yeah, it just seemed like a fun way to do that in quite a play-like fashion.
It's the kind of scene that I want to do an anatomy of a scene breakdown of, because it is it's a brilliant scene, and the performances that the two have with each other, it's like, who's got the higher ground at that moment, and just getting to see them work against each other, it's really, really brilliant stuff. So it's a lot to be proud of there.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they did so well.
With that in mind, with, you know, the darkness of this kind of story, what's the mood on set like, and how do you maintain whatever the mood is on set?
I mean, the mood on set, this was a mobile home that was built in a studio. So we had a very small crew, but we were all crammed together for the entire duration of the shoot in this one space. So everyone kind of went a little bit crazy, but in a good way. No one wanted to kill each other by the end of it. We were all just kind of a bit delirious and delusional, which was kind of how you end up on most film sets, but this one especially, because it was so contained and we were in the dark, not seeing sunlight for a very long time. But I guess in terms of like the actual mood between everyone, our two leads, Brendan and Jordan, are, unlike their characters in the film, they are peppy, effervescent, very loud, vivacious, crazy people. So, you know, in between takes it was all laughter and chatter, there was no real method darkness going on. Everyone was kind of just having fun with it.
That's right. And there was select scenes, as you can imagine, where we were very much staying in the zone, but because it is all one location continual time and holds a certain tone for the whole time, you just couldn't stay all the time in that zone. If the actors had wanted that, we definitely would have given it to them, but it just would have been, it was tiring enough for them as it was. But yeah, and I think it's like, as things progress, without spoilers, throughout the film, as things get a bit darker, like, we shot part of that real time in one location thing was that we essentially shot in order, in chronological order.
Yeah.
So that was good because we had rehearsed the first two thirds so much. It was kind of like, it was pretty easy for us to slip into the first two thirds, wasn't it? And then it was really there's an appropriate level of as things are darker, we're all naturally a bit more tired and stuff like that. So the in between takes is a bit quiet. It was just it funnily enough, the chronological order, that's not why we did it, but it kind of ended up being good because as people are getting more tired in real life, so are the characters.
Yeah.
Not working really well.
Yeah.
How long did you shoot for as well?
We shot initially for 21 days, I want to say, and then we did a couple of days of pickups.
Yeah.
As well.
It's interesting. I watched recently Rev Paco, but it was like there was this really interesting kind of vibe of trying to decide what Adelaide filmmaker is like. And it's like, well, you know, if I had to think of what an Adelaide filmmaker would be, like Paco and your films, coming back to sound, it's like, well, it kind of makes sense that sound and visual design of it is really what an Adelaide filmmaker is. Have you ever thought about what being a filmmaker in South Australia means?
Yeah, I mean, I think what a lot of people talk about is, you know, our shooting locations in South Australia, because we have access to vastly different environments in a really short space of time. So I think that that's something that lots of South Australian filmmakers kind of pride themselves upon, is like beautiful shooting locations, because one second you've got the beach, you've got the city, then you've got wine country, areas that can be made to look like jungle, areas that can be made to look like desert. So I think that's something that a lot of South Australians, you know, pride themselves on in terms of filmmaking. But yeah, in terms of sound, that's an interesting observation. They're kind of like strange sister films in a way, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, Paco is wonderful. I had such a joyous time watching it, and then chatting with them afterwards as well. Like, it's such a, as you're saying, like the visual language and style of Adelaide is, it's so diverse. You know, you've got so many different things happening, and yet on the same hand, like, as you're saying, you shot this in a set, and you know, you've got the soundstage and all this kind of stuff, and then there are the moments where we get to see outside, and that in itself is a visually stunning location too. Can you talk about making sure that the two married up, and, you know, the outside and the inside looked the same?
I mean, we were really worried about that.
Yeah.
Like, in all honesty, we were like, oh, how do we make this work? Because we knew that we wanted to build a set for this film. It's like one of those things that, yes, it's a big cost to shoot in a studio for a low budget film, and yes, it's a big cost to create a set, but it actually saves us so much time and money in the long run, because you have total control, and also you don't have to compete against all the things that you normally compete against when you're out on a location in an environment where you have angry neighbors coming to tell everyone to get their cars off the street.
That's
and
right.
You've got birds interrupting, you know, and real storms. If, as funny as it is, we didn't want a real storm during our shoot. So yeah, in the long run, we knew that we wanted to shoot inside a set. But we did have this worry of, gosh, we have to actually make this believable. And also, as we were talking about before, make it feel like the storm is really there, really outside, and that we're not shooting in a sound studio. So that was something we talked to Max Corkendale, our cinematographer, about a lot, how we can pepper in moments where an actor looks out a window or draws back a curtain or opens the door, and we see physical rain and we see the exterior location to remind us that it's really there and it's really happening, and then let sound do the rest of it when we're contained inside the house. But hilariously, the exterior location is literally our set that we transported to an exterior but erected as just a flat. So we could only shoot it from the front. Because if you moved left or right, you would see that there nothing existed behind it. Yeah.
And technically, it's like moving in the breeze.
Yeah.
You had to strap it down. It looked terrible from all other angles. But, I mean, yeah, for a film of this scale, that stuff, those were our visual effects. Like, you know what I mean? It was we planned those as if they were big effect shots. In reality, they weren't big.
Yeah.
But that was just, they were the big challenges on our scale. And those tended to be, when we broke away from shooting in chronological order, in that we, you know, we had a day where we were shooting towards the trailer home, and we did have rain in the studio. So a little mini rig was built that, again, looked silly from all other angles. And we just had to, we just storyboarded out certain sequences to know that we wanted to look out this angle. So we just planned it for that. And the exterior, again, was a night shoot that we just crammed a lot in.
Yeah. And I think it's also a testament to our production design team.
Yeah.
Because they, when the house feels so lived in and it feels so authentic and they've added all these details to make it feel like it's a real home, audiences aren't looking for the trick. You know what I mean? They just believe it. So yeah, we had a great production design team that just really made it feel like it was really authentic, so that you don't really question, does the inside match the outside? You just kind of absorb it.
Yeah. The best compliment we've had, which isn't an us thing. This is the team around us planning and just executing it really well, is that we keep getting asked if it was shot in studio or on location.
Yeah.
So, cause you know, we didn't know because we were there. So yeah, we're editing it and we're just going the whole time, oh,
hope this works.
Hope people buy this. Yeah. But you know, by the time you've got amazing sound design in there to tie it all together, yeah, it just seamlessly worked.
Mm.
We'll say I did sit there near the climax. I'm like, surely they didn't shoot this in an actual, like out in an actual caravan park kind of thing. Like, surely not. But yeah, it makes sense. Like, logically, I know how films are made and all this kind of stuff, but it's still, when you get absorbed in a plot and absorbed in a film, it's easy to just forget that the whole team has gone into making something. Also had that experience. It's interesting as well. I was talking to the Bird Eater guys earlier today, and they were talking about feeling like they're part of an emerging group of Australian filmmakers, and you know, this group of Australian filmmakers who are recontextualizing what Australia is on screen and all this kind of stuff. Do you feel like that yourselves? And I know that you've had a relationship with having films screen over in America, so I'm curious if you can talk about being Australian filmmakers now and being part of a group, and also having that kind of following, I guess, in America.
I mean, it's been really cool to see and hear everything that's happening. I mean, because we just had this film premiere at Tribeca, and talking to people over there, everyone was talking about Australian films and specifically Australian genre films at the moment. And we're really excited about it. So we were kind of like, oh, that's really cool.
Mm.
And basically I think it's cool to see Australia branching out in terms of what it's making, the kind of content that it's producing, because Australia is one of those countries that we have such an image of being this gorgeous, you know, suntanned country where everyone's nice, and you know, there's this kind of like beautiful image, which is largely true. Australians are amazing people, and you know, we have amazing beaches and gorgeous locations, but we also have a kind of underbelly of lots of hideous stuff that goes on in Australia, and some of it is really unpleasant and some people are horrible. And we have lots of isolated towns and areas where, you know, people aren't well looked after, and it breeds really interesting personalities and characters that you often don't see in Australian films, because often it's the suntanned, gorgeous man with a ute, you know what I mean, who's got his dog in the back and all that kind of stuff, which is great.
It is.
But it is cool to see, you know, them branching out and showing different sides of Australia, and really interesting sides of Australia that I think lean into horror and thriller territories really well, just because I think there's lots of cool untold stories out there that feel like that they belong to Australia, with Australian actors and Australian locations that are yet to be told. So it feels cool, like, that we're hearing all this positive stuff about specifically Australian genre films coming out at the moment.
And I think even like physically executing a film has changed. I was going to say it is easier. It's really hard, but it's in the past, there's only been certain avenues to get your film made in Australia, and they're amazing, but it's hard to not to some capacity make them also want to be good tourist ads as well. That's not so, there are so many amazing Australian films, but the advent of digital cameras, you know, 5 years ago there were digital cameras, but we wouldn't have been able to do this film on this kind of digital camera. So I think there's a wave of people who are just starting off, just kind of jump-starting their own stuff. And because they're not having to go through the traditional avenues straight out the gate, I think they're just potentially feeling a bit more freedom to just take a swing and go for something that's unique for them, rather than it having to kind of
tick
a lot of boxes.
Yeah.
And again, that's not so, so much amazing Australian content, amazing Australian films, but I think that has to be connected to why there's a bit of a new wave of unique stories coming. It's just, we're in a super amazing time as far as the technology goes, that we can go and film stuff, cut stuff, produce stuff ourselves. It's a really exciting time.